Scott Oates, sitting in for Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. For most people, safaris evoke romantic images of great grassy savannas, majestic elephants walking off into the red sunset, the lions roaring at night. Camera-toting tourists work on their bush eyes so they can hunt down gazelles, rhinos, warthogs, zebra, and the wildebeest in the kind of a new nonviolent version of Ernest Hemingway's explorations. But the writer and scholar, Jay Kaiser, isn't like most khaki-clad adventurers. While his companions are marveling at wild dogs, he's worried they'll tear him to shreds. When his family and friends admire the novelty of a toothbrush tree, he's more concerned about whether his toothbrush is safe in the tent. Although he says safaris terrify him, our guest Jay Kaiser has been on three of them, and he's going back for more. He's what you'd call an accidental tourist. Gaby Whitehouse runs her own safari travel business called CATS, Custom African Travel Service, and has been working to convert Kaiser to the bush way of life. Connection listeners, help her out this morning. Can you convince Jay Kaiser that the three vacations he's hated the most are exactly the ones he should love the best? 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK makes the safari connection today. And a good morning to Jay Kaiser and Gaby Whitehouse. How are you doing today?
Hi, Bob.
Fine, great.
Jay, let's start with you. What is it you hate? Tell us what bothers you the most about these vacations that you keep going on.
Well, like, the first time I went on a vacation, I went to Tanzania. And we landed in Arusha, which is 250 miles from Kitum Cave. Now, Kitum Cave is where they located Ebola. Why would anybody want to come within 25,000 miles? I mean, it's that 250 miles is close enough. It's like Ebola's in New York, and I'm in Boston. I mean, I'm going to go to Canada. It's the wrong direction.
Jay, was that the time you were reading The Coming Plague every night when you were going to sleep?
Yes, exactly. The Coming Plague, and also the, what was it called, the Hot Zone?
Yes, that was your nighttime reading to dream about.
Ebola just terrified me. And so I'm going to go to the, you know, to the land where it's at. It's a horrible disease.
But you still went.
Yes, I did. You probably want to know why.
That would be a good question to ask right now, perhaps?
Well, because I'm out of my mind. The truth of the matter is, my partner lives to travel. She's been to Nepal. She's been to the foot of K2. She's lived on an ashram in Abad Nagar, India. And you just don't live with somebody for a lifetime, you know. You don't live with somebody without participating in the most important part of their life. If I were to say to her, look, you go travel and I'll stay home, then essentially a whole room in her mental museum would be closed to me. So I have to go. The other thing is that suppose I've often said to myself, well, suppose I stay home. I mean, suppose what I do is she'll go and I'll stay home and I'll say, look, at on Tuesday, after you've been there for a week, call me. And she'll say, okay, I'll call you. And what happens is, as often happens on safari, you know, they're a little late, they can't get to a phone, they get to the phone, it's broken. And so she doesn't call. I'm going to be eaten up with anxiety. So the question for me is, where do I want to be anxious? Do I want to be anxious at home alone, or do I want to be anxious on safari with my partner? Well, clearly, with my partner.
It's better to worry about being eaten by the lions on safari than to be eaten by anxiety at home.
Well, that's exactly right.
That's not a choice.
I mean, you know, we came within, I mean, if your listeners could see, I'm holding my two fingers an inch apart. We came that close to being eaten by lions. The thing that amazes me is,
Now, Jay, it was not that close.
You see, the thing that amazes me is I'm the only one who takes seriously that there are perils there. Everybody else that I go on, now look, I'm not paranoid. I'm going to read you. The last time I went on safari was in Kenya, and the safari guide there had me sign a paper which says, I have been informed and am aware, I'm quoting now, I have been informed and am aware that adventure travel can be dangerous and include certain risks and dangers, including but not limited to. And then there follows a list of dangers that would make a Stanley quake. You know, a death by this, death by that. So I'm everybody's blithely signing it. And I'm looking around and I'm saying to myself, these people are out of their minds. I mean, this is not a joke. And so that's how I feel.
Tell us about the lion episode.
Well,
go into greater detail.
Well,
and then we'll sort out what's fact and what's fiction.
Okay. Well, now Gaby was actually with us. We were walking in an oxbow. And
in Zambia.
This was in Zambia, right. Where was it?
South Luangwa National Park in Zambia.
Yeah.
You mean in an area between two rivers, an area where the river...
Exactly. The river had dried out. A dried out river.
Okay.
Okay, so they're looking for lions. Now, they divide us up into two groups. There were 12 of us on this trip, and six had seen lions the previous day. And so now we six go, and we're looking for lions. Okay, now, first of all, I think you're out of your mind to go looking for lions. Why would you want to go look for them? I mean, you know what they look like, for God's sake. And then what happens is that we're walking along, and so it's a four-hour walk, and we're into our fourth hour, and I figure I'm lucky, no lions. But Gaby, and I blame her for this, she was intrepid. She wanted to see these lions. So we walk along a dirt road. There's a spot. There's a spot in the road, and it's a red spot. And in the middle of the spot is a mound. I figure the mound is dung, because whenever you look down in Africa, what you're walking on is either dirt or dung. And so the guy kicks it. And out of this little this mound comes a bunch of little green bugs. He says, that's an impala's stomach. And there's been a fresh kill. So we're walking a little further, and we see another one. And then Gaby sees a battler eagle flying in the sky over by a clump of trees. She says, oh, let's go over there. Now, I mean, I think a rational...
The sign of the circling bird?
Well, actually, the battler was sitting on the tree looking down at the rumen from the killed impalas, and there were vultures also sitting there. And we were surprised how close the lions really were.
To where you were?
Yes. And that's what happened, is that we got a little too close, and they roared up because we were in their comfort zone. So what you do then...
You were a threat to their kill.
There were four females with nine cubs. And when their cubs concerned, the females are very protective. And we just stumbled on their territory and got too close. So we all started backing up as a group. And
well, slowly or quickly.
Let me give my version. So we're going along a single file, and we're all looking in the thicket on our left, when all of a sudden, on our right, about 20 yards away, these four lionesses jump up. And there is a roar that sounds like it comes from, 1,000 miles away. I mean, it is an incredible sound. I have never been so frightened in my life. And I looked at these lions, and I said, that's it. I'm dead. That's it. I'm gone. And so immediately, everybody lines up. The guy with the gun gets in front, and the guide goes in front, and he says, back up. Very slowly. Back up.
And stay together. Nobody run.
I didn't, by the way, I'm scared to death, but I didn't panic. I did what I was told. And
there was somebody on each side of him holding
They were holding me. That's right. George was on one side.
My husband, George, who's very intrepid, was
And George, can you imagine what he did? He had his other hand, one hand on me, and the other hand he had it in his pocket, where he had this like 3-inch pocket knife to defend himself against four lionesses. Anyway, there's this one lioness who, she comes up in the front. She's an alpha female, and she starts to paw the ground, and her tail twitches. Now, thank God, I don't know what that means, but people who know about lion behavior say they're just a hair trigger away from attacking.
Their tail is twitching.
When their tail is twitching and they're pawing the ground.
Well, that's what they do when they hunt, too. They signal with their tails. That's part of it.
So we're backing up slowly. And then after we back up about 6 or 8 feet, I look over my shoulder and I whisper to the guide, I said, we got to stop backing up. And he says, why? And I said, we're backing into a hippopotamus.
This is all true.
Now, I ask you, I don't need this. I mean, I was, before this safari, I was having a vodka martini. And I was having a vodka martini in my house, and I was listening to Eric Satie on the stereo, and occasionally I'd tune into WBUR to listen to The Connection. That's a civilized life. But you don't go looking for this kind of trouble. It's insane. But the woman that I live with, that's what she does, so I go with it.
Did anyone get a picture?
It all happened too fast, and there was high grass. But there was a video taken and of our reactions afterwards. And I should say as a qualifier that I've gone on walking safaris at least 50 times. And this is the only time something like this has ever happened. And the guide that I have seen subsequently is still shaking his head about and saying, I really goofed this. This will never happen again. That was a very, very unusual incident. That's all. And I mean, it's great for Jay that he was there because it's given him wonderful material. But it's very unusual to have that happen.
You don't exactly look like you think it was great for you to be there.
No, and see, that's another thing. The thing is that I guess, I mean, just to understand, why don't people understand my terror? And the reason is because they don't know that I attract these incidents. I mean, if I'm not on the safari, nothing like this will happen. But if I'm there, something like this will happen. I mean, every time I've been on safari, I've either gotten sick or I've almost been killed by a lion or there's an Egyptian cobra escapes in the snake garden. All of this is absolutely true. I mean, I think that you have to understand that I am what's called a risk avoider. And there are, you know, genetically, there's some reason to suppose that people are divided up into adventurers and risk avoiders, risk takers and risk avoiders. Gaby's a risk taker. Mm-hmm. I mean, for her, this is life. For me, it's death.
1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, we're talking about safaris on The Connection. Have you ever been on one? Would you like to go on one? Are you a little less willing to go at this moment than you were 5 minutes ago when you started listening to Jay talk about his experiences? Gaby Whitehouse, tell us your experiences, your big picture experience here of what you think safaris are really like and why they're good experiences.
Well, I think that Africa is an irresistible draw to the imagination. It's sort of the place where we all came from, where we used to hunt animals to live, where there's wide open savannas, where it's just sun-drenched, beautiful, and animals roaming free. And this is a great contrast to January in Boston. So a lot of people really start thinking about escape at this time, and I think historically that's been true. Africa's attracted people from weary Europe to come there to seek out the much more visceral, physical encounters with the world. And I think there's something that's sort of basic about our human nature that gets aroused by going there. It's sort of an archetypal memory or something, if you will. And I think that just that being there among the animals gives people a great feeling of oneness with their environment.
What is it that captures, you're choking on this, what is it that captures your imagination?
I'm particularly partial to the birds. I've been on so many safaris so many times that after a while seeing the lions and the elephants, while it's always interesting, the birds are constantly fascinating and they're so colorful and beautiful and their behavior is so interesting that I've become the bird lady on the safaris. And that's the part that I really, that's what draws me back year after year.
How many have you been on now?
I've lost count. I started in 1980 and I've been on 2, 3, or 4 a year. Only a couple of those years have I not gone at all. So it's been, and I've done gorilla trekking and I've done I've done 5-day walks in the heart of Zambia. I've done really exotic explorations, places where you can't go anymore now.
Why not?
Well, because of political problems in Rwanda, for instance, where the mountain gorillas are, and Uganda. People are going back there now, but it's not exactly how it was. So there are things that you can't do that I have done, and I'm grateful that I had that opportunity.
And tourism is on the increase in other places such as South Africa.
Yeah, South Africa is very in now. Luxury accommodations, or I mean, it's unbelievably, it's 6-star over there. There's a company that is building the most extravagant, elaborate air-conditioned tents and everything else. So people are amazed that they expect to have a hearty existence on safari, but they usually gain 10 pounds because the food is incredible. The amenities are really unexpectedly luxurious. But I prefer a little more rugged than that, but still, we're always comfortable. Good vehicles. The key to a good safari is having the best available guide, which I always feel is makes the experience, and that's kind of what we specialize in, finding the best people to take you out. And they have to have good vehicles and know how to fix them, because the roads there are a challenge. So it's important to go with people who know what they're doing.
Pre-planning.
You have to spend at least 6 months ahead to plan. People can't just pick up the phone and go on a safari next week.
Well, how do you find these people?
that want to go on safari?
Help you arrange these trips. And how much does it cost?
Well, I've been doing this for a long time. I started the Natural History Travel Program at Harvard's Museum of Comparative Zoology back in 75 and started going to Africa in 1980. And it's like with everything else, it's over the years gaining the experience, meeting people along the way. I've represented a group called the Safari Guides Company, which is the best guides in each of 8 countries that we work in. And so it's over the years building up these relationships. These guides have become like family members. And then in the rainy season, they come over to Boston to get away from the rains. And so we always call it the invasion of the safari guides. And they give slide talks and get to know people here. So, we build up a continuing relationship with these people. And we trust them like you would family. And that's what makes a big difference.
And the cost?
The cost, it varies. It's always expensive. There's no point trying to do a bargain safari because it's going to cost, just for the flight, $1,500 to $1,800. And then the land can vary from $3,000 to $5,000 to $6,000 to $7,000 for a 2-week safari.
So it's expensive and out of the reach of many people, actually.
Yes, that's unfortunately true, but some people sort of save up for a lifetime experience. We find that most of the travelers really are ones that whose children have already finished college. There are people doing family safaris now, but obviously that taking kids along greatly increases the cost. But there's a lot of people with money these days, as we know. The stock market's doing well, and there's a lot of money being spent on travel, and obviously these very luxurious places are having pretty good capacity, so somebody is able to afford it.
Connection listeners, have you ever dreamed about safari? What do you think it would be like? If you've been, what was it like? Did it live up to your imagination or your expectations? 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to the phones. George, you're on the connection. Thanks for calling. Oh, George?
Hey.
Hi,
yes.
George. Go ahead.
Yes, I was listening to Jay talking about being an accidental tourist and how he gets stuck going with his wife and he deals with it. And I think in the end he's very happy he does all these things. But what was interesting to me, what immediately I thought of, was my wife Margot and her mother, before I met her, my wife, they had traveled all over the world in all 7 continents. They had been on safari, and particularly in India. Bear in mind, first, my mother-in-law is afraid of the smallest little cute dog in the world. If she sees it, she will skirt away and run and be like, get that thing away from me. Mm-hmm. And yet in India, she was on top of an elephant being pulled by some guy who, is just wearing, a towel practically, pulling them through the jungle. He'll go to the bathroom or whatever in the jungle and leave them sitting on an elephant, and he tells the elephant to come in, and it sits there. And then she's just sitting there, and she's not even the least bit afraid. And even my wife has the sense to be at least kind of concerned. And just all kinds of traveling like that. 5 days of traveling to get to Antarctica for 5 hours of, land time in the worst high seas imaginable on a Russian icebreaker. I don't understand why some people aren't the least bit afraid, but, it's in the blood, I guess.
Now, I've noticed you haven't yet said that you've been with your wife.
Oh, well, we've gone to some places that are a little bit tamer. For our honeymoon, we went to the Galapagos Islands, and that was great. It was very safe, and I was a little ambivalent swimming with, all kinds of things that I'd never swam before, not least of all sharks. You see a shark 6 feet away from you, and they tell you they're going to be there, and they tell you not to be afraid. But every time you go in the water, what you think of is, the first thing I'm going to see are these big eyes coming at me, and I'm going to be dead. But it was great. You see them, and then instantly, with this shark at least, you could realize that they weren't afraid of you. They were afraid of you, and then all of a sudden you're completely not afraid of it. But doesn't apply to lions in the jungle.
But I have to get to this with you. What was it that made it great? When you're looking at that shark that
adrenaline.
You're deathly afraid of.
It's like why people jump out of a plane, which I'll never do, but it's just, it's exciting. I love scary movies, although it's different being in a movie theater. When you have complete safety, knowing you could at least just close your eyes or run if you're horrified, but it's like that kind of thing. Why do people like to be scared? And then in the end, we drag all this camera equipment around, so we have a good record of it, and people will see some of the pictures and they'll go, you're crazy. But, I could totally appreciate what Jay was saying.
Hey, Jay Kaiser is, however, shaking his head at this moment.
Well, George, I think, I'm glad you understand how I feel, because I feel as if you do.
Yes.
The Irish have a saying, when you're born to hang, you can go to sea in a basket. And so I believe that. And therefore, when I get into these situations, what sort of descends on me is a curtain of numbness. I've been in... Excuse me, George. I've been in these little Cessna 206 planes, you know, just a room. I'm sort of a heavy guy, and there's just barely room for me. And I mean, once I'm in the plane, I figure, well, if I'm born to hang, I can go to sea in a Cessna. Mm-hmm. What can I do?
But the look, air in a bit.
you mentioned the Galapagos. I know some people. I know somebody who knows some people who were killed going to the Galapagos Islands.
Oh, yeah, the group of people that were...
Elder Hostel.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
That was 2 weeks before we left. We were like, okay, boats are sinking. And you,
and you went anyway?
Well, you know, you're not going to just get... It's your honeymoon. If it's meant to be, well, at least it's romantic.
Well... I tell you, George, I admire you, and I understand you. Your spouse is a very lucky woman.
Oh, I'm lucky, too. Let me get that in. I'll be in trouble.
Jay Kaiser, do you get the adrenaline rush?
No. I don't like to see horror films. I mean, I hated The Silence of the Lambs. I'm not going to go see Titus. Why would anybody ever want to do this? Why do you want to do this to yourself? You see, I think I'm just a different creature. I'm sure there are some people out there like me, but I don't like horror films. I want to go to films that where people are nice to one another. And the adrenaline rush is, you know what I did after the lion incident? I drank 4 gin and tonics in a row. I mean, talk about binge drinking. I was so wired. And then I went back to camp and I collapsed for 2 hours. And then when I woke up, I wrote about it.
I was just going to ask you that. You're focused enough to write about it.
Yes, and I'm going to...
That's your escape, isn't it?
Exactly. You see, I'm going to tell you something about myself. You know, I was in therapy for 3.5 years, and what my shrink told me was...
And how long have you been going on safari? 3.5 years?
Yeah. Yes, you know, I never thought of that. I think I'm going to go back into therapy. Anyway, I was in therapy for 3.5 years, and what my shrink said to me before we ended, he said, you know, you have a great talent for externalizing pain. And that's what I did. When I go on safari, I'm really in pain. And how do I deal with it? I write about it. So 2 hours a day, I can leave these people. I can leave this land. I can leave these animals. And I can just go between me and my Newton Message Pad 2000. And it gives me enough strength to come out of it and feel like I can face the next day.
Do you write about it the way you speak about it?
I try to, yeah. Yeah, I really try to. In fact, it's just a conversation I have with my Newton message pen.
Mm-hmm. Gabby, do you get the adrenaline rush?
No. I'm not crazy about horror films either, and I'm not really a thrill seeker. And I try not to think about some of these things that Jay dwells on in great detail, because I know that I want to be there because the overall feeling is wonderful for me. And the minute the plane lands in Africa, I'm there. It's just, you know, a very special sensation that I don't want to give up. But I know there are dangers. I know there are problems. And I think that's true in daily life all the time. You can either focus on them or not. And I choose not to, and to enjoy the parts that I really go for and have experiences that you can't have anywhere else.
So the reward outweighs the risk.
Definitely. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing it.
And the reward for you is more than the birds.
Yeah, the reward is, it's sort of hard to put into words, because it's a really emotional coming together with something that I didn't know existed in me before I went there. I went there the first time when I was 40. And all of a sudden something woke up, and I said, this is where I was always meant to be. It sounds corny, but I'm not alone in that experience. A lot of people have written that that's the effect that Africa's had on them. And, you know, I wouldn't have had the opportunity to ride an elephant for 5 days and things like that that I have been able to do staying home in Cambridge. So I am an experience freak. I really love new experiences and trying them out, but I don't dwell on what the dangers could be, and I certainly wouldn't jump out of a plane or do anything, or bungee jump, or I'm not a thrill seeker in that way, but I really love getting into a completely different environment.
So psychologically, do you feel you have to compartmentalize the experience so that You can enjoy what you are experiencing instead of having the fear or the anxiety dominate.
Oh, sure. I don't sit in that small plane and think it could crash any minute. Otherwise, I wouldn't enjoy it. You know, I mean, you have to block out things that are not pleasant. But I think Jay doesn't block those out, or there's some part of him that needs to feel all those things. My need is to not feel those things and to go on with the experience. And I think that I represent more of the people that go on safari than Jay does.
You're not compartmentalizing at all, are you? You're living the moment.
No, that's it. I don't have any ability to sort of strain things out. It's just everything. I mean, I feel when I go to Africa the way I feel in an art museum. I get overloaded very quickly. I can't really spend more than an hour in a museum because there's so much there, and I get very irritated and very nervous. And so what I try to do is, it's not that I'm averse to traveling. Like Nancy and I go, we actually travel, we'll take a weekend to go to Paris to look at Monet's water lilies. Now that, to me, is a nice thing to do. You go and you're surrounded by Japanese ladies who don't have knives or anything, you know.
There's not much threatening about oil on canvas.
No, exactly. But I have to say that there are things in Africa that are mind-boggling, and I wish I could see them without all of this noise of trepidation, but I can't. For example, I remember one day. We were in a riverine forest. Do you want me to stop and you have to do something?
I think I'm going to ask you to hold that thought until after the break, because we do need to take a break. Our guests are Jay Kaiser, reluctant traveler, and Gaby Whitehouse, who runs her own safari group. We're talking about safaris this hour on The Connection. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI, Public Radio International.
Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners at WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at allaire.com.
This is Bob Oakes sitting in for Christopher Lydon on The Connection today. This is the Safari Connection. We're talking about travel to places that sometimes excites you, sometimes excites you in ways that you don't particularly care to be excited. Why do you go if you've been? What did you like about it? If you've been, has it scared the bejesus out of you? And is that the reason you liked it? Is that the reason you want to go back? Our guests are two safari experts, I guess, two experienced travelers, Gaby Whitehouse, who runs her own safari group called CATS, Custom African Travel Service, and our reluctant traveler, jazz musician, writer, MIT provost, Jay Kaiser, who just before the break was about to tell us, was about to relate an experience of something that he did enjoy.
Yes, I didn't want to get the idea, people to get the idea that Africa is not an incredible place to see. It's just that I'm always filled with trepidation when I'm there. And the one I could mention many of them, I suppose, but one that occurs to me is watching 106 elephants in a meadow, just sort of making their way slowly across the meadow. And they were eating as they go, as elephants do. I think they eat up to 300 pounds of grass a day. And they were absolutely quiet. You could barely hear them. In fact, that morning, I had been on a walk where I was shown a mound where there were termites. And the termites were working away under this mound. They were actually building little tunnels across a path. It's their version, I suppose, of the big dig. Mm-hmm. And they made more noise than the elephants, which was amazing to me, to see that kind of a contrast. You see, Africa is that. It's sort of those contrasts. Like in William Boyd's novel, The Ice Cream Wars, he has the protagonist say that the sky in Africa looks higher than it does anyplace else. And that's true, because apparently it's a meteorological fact that the clouds are higher above the African continent than they are above other continents. And so it gives you the impression that the skies are higher there. I was once sitting on a rock overlooking it was out in the middle of nowhere, and we'd been walking with a tribe called the Dorobo. They're a very interesting tribe. They're only one of four tribes in the world that have no military structure. No such thing as a military structure. And Dorobo, I think there are only 600 of them left. And they're probably going to be extinct because the Maasai are buying up their women for brides so that the Dorobos will not be able to reproduce. And anyway, I was sitting on this rock, and everybody had wanted to go look for baboons. And I wanted to stay and write this journal because I was being overloaded. And so I stayed, and I started writing the journal. And then when I looked up, I looked around, and everybody had disappeared. I mean, I couldn't see anybody. I was there on this rock with a 360-degree panorama view of this savanna, and I've never felt so completely irrelevant in my life. Africa is no place for the ego. It does not surprise me that 500,000 years ago, Homo erectus got out of Africa.
Defined as ego.
So what keeps you, beyond being the good companion, what keeps drawing you back? Why are you going again?
Well, it's a very, people ask me to go, and they say if I go, they'll pay my way, and they'll also pay Nancy's way. I was talking to the editor of the new editor of the Atlantic Monthly, Michael Kelly, and he had read a piece that I've done that's going to appear sometime in the spring in the Atlantic, and he said, Jay, the way for you to get over your fear of traveling is to get people to pay your way. and the fact of the matter, the fact is that, you know, I couldn't, how could I possibly say no? Because it would deprive Nancy of a trip. You understand? So I can't say no. I really feel as if I'm trapped. But I'm telling you honestly, if I did not have to go to Africa, I wouldn't go.
Maybe people want you to go because they can place all their fears in your body.
Well, you know, at the end of it,
there's something to that.
Yeah. And I have to tell you, look, Africa gives me something to write about. I found, for example, when I went to Italy, in fact, Gaby and George and Nancy and I spent 2 weeks in Italy together, and I wrote about it. I wrote a journal, but the journal didn't have anywhere near the edge that the African one has, because Italy is incredible. It's, you know, I love it there. But I guess the thing is, one of the things I get about it is it gives me something against which to push when I write. You know what I'm saying?
Well, Africa's really aroused a lot of literature over the years because it's just the place of the imagination. So the people who go tend to write about it. It's just that rich.
When people go, Gaby Whitehouse, do they go because they're looking for the large experience, or do they go because they're looking specifically to see the elephant and the hippo and the wildlife?
I think they're going to find out what Africa's all about. It's sort of a mystery place. Travel demystifies when you actually go there and see it for yourself. I think people do want to know about how people live there, what the politics and culture are, but it's not that easy to become aware of it. You can visit villages, you can encounter people in some contexts. But if they go thinking that they're going to have a real human-to-human experience, they're usually a little disappointed. In Kenya, where they've been independent for a long time, you have more of a one-on-one relationship with the African people that work with you. In Southern Africa, it's still much more separate, and you really just meet the people that are running the camps, and you don't have that much contact with the local people. Having said that, when we went to Malawi last year, Nancy, Jay's partner, set up a party with all these Malawi chief muckety-mucks over there, the ones that run the country, for us to meet. And it was a delightful evening. Everybody sort of talked politely to each other. But it's not like going to Europe where we're much more similar. That life is so different from ours that I think it's hard for people to sort of relate. That every now and then you get an experience that really works. At one camp that we were, the one of the men there was the chief of his village, and he set up a visit for us to go there, and we brought presents, and they gave us presents, and it was a really formal visit where they showed us how they're building their school, and the women showed us their houses and their kitchens, and it was a really warm exchange, and we were honored guests, and, you know, the whole thing was set up in a very respectful way. They do have all kinds of visiting villages where you sort of go in and poke around, and it feels very intrusive, and I don't feel comfortable about visiting these local villages in that way. So it's still being worked out. It's very hard to get these two cultures to really understand each other on such a short basis. I mean, people who work over there have a completely different experience, but a safari is typically 2 weeks, and it's sort of a gee-wow experience and not something where you really have a chance to get to know another culture well. But you do have a chance to see the wildlife well, you know, so that's more accessible.
Connection listeners, if you've been, have you been on safari for the GWOW experience, or have you been for the greater understanding of Africa and the culture of South Africa, for example? 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to the phones. Ian, you're on the Connection.
Hi, how are you guys?
Great. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Tell us about your experience. Have you been?
Yeah, I have been. I actually probably took a slightly different tack than a lot of the readers. I actually studied there. I went through a U.S. school called St. Lawrence University, who has a junior year abroad program there. And while the animals are beautiful, I think one of the most unique components of it are the people. And that really enriches the experience. I have, you know, a host of stories of being out in the Mara or in Zaire in the Virunga Mountains with the gorillas. But I think the combination of both animals, there's a spirit in the place that's irreplaceable.
That's true. That's true.
Give us, tell us about your most significant human experience.
I spent a lot of time with the Maasai. I learned how to speak Swahili when I was there. And went out and lived with the Maasai family, with my girlfriend, now wife. And just to see the interaction, and I think what's so unique is you have people that, you know, the per capita income is something like $200 a year, and they're the most giving, forthright people that you'd ever experience anywhere. And it just blends in with when you see their natural relationship and their natural rhythms sort of coincide with that of the animals in and around the Mara. It's priceless.
And where was this?
In Kenya.
Mm-hmm. And have you been back since? Oh, this was were during your college years?
Yeah, in 83 I've been back actually four times since. The last time was about 5 years ago for just about a year. In addition to living and working with the Maasai then, we also did go down to Malawi, also went into the Virunga Mountains. This is just when all the explosion in Rwanda happened. In our perspective, one of the reasons we actually went after to see the gorillas was we knew that was going to change, that, you know, that's one of those moments that's not going to be available for anyone. And, you know, we hiked in 6 hours and found the gorillas, and it was one of those milestones in memory.
I'm sorry, Jay Pastor, go ahead.
Nina taka kwenda nyumba. Ian, I just said, I want to go home in Swahili. Ah, that's wonderful.
See, I and knew he it, said.
What did you say, Ian?
Really do.
Ah, right.
Ian, thank you so much for your call, and I hope you get back soon. 1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Let's go back to the phones. Vanilla is on the line right now. Hi there.
Hello, Bob. It's Vanilla. I'm Indian, and I've spent a year in South Africa and all over Africa. And the point I would like to make is that by defining your travel as a safari and scheduling it, that I think you're implicitly going to see the animals. I mean, the African safari, brings the image of the lion. And I think even within a constrained situation, a tour, which, you know, by definition is a programmed experience, I think the individual has natural curiosity. And if the person goes for a walk, you know, 5 minutes outside, and of course you have to exert your judgment there. You know, you don't want to, you know, be in the middle of Serengeti and just go for a walk there.
No.
But I think you can have the kind of enlivening and enlightening experiences by even talking to the bartenders and the drivers But not in a cliched format, but by allowing your natural curiosity to come out. I think it's completely possible. And I've traveled on my own, and I've been on safaris, and both cases I've had the most amazing experiences.
Jay Kaiser is nodding his head in agreement.
Yeah, well, I think what she said is exactly right. I had a conversation with a bartender who wanted to know if I'd been circumcised. And I said, yes. And I said, how about you? He said, yes, I was circumcised when I was 18. And I said, did it hurt? And he said, yes, it did. Well, why did you wait so long? And he said, well, you see, I was to become a leader of my group. And I had to do this in order to show that I could be a leader. He asked me, how old were you? And I said, oh, I was about 8 days old. I can't remember it. But that was a very interesting exchange. I mean, he was a guy for whom circumcision was a rite of passage. I think the most interesting conversation I had, though, was with a Maasai driver, in which I really indicated my the narrowness of my view of things. You mentioned that I play jazz, and so I was driving with this driver, and I said, you know, do you like jazz? And he said, no, I prefer rock music. And I said, oh, that's really unfortunate, you know, because your ancestors created it, you know, in New Orleans. And what an irony that, you know, and he said, excuse me, they weren't my ancestors. And I said, and then I realized that I really had put my foot in it. And he said, I'm a Maasai. And he said the slavers did not come to the Maasai because they knew that the Maasai would kill them. And he said, not only did we protect our own tribe, but we protected the tribes who lived behind us, like the Kikuyu, for example. And that kind of exchange was a very powerful one for me because I realized that, you know, I was sort of seeing the world in two dimensions when it was multidimensional.
Mm. From the context of the cab.
Yeah, and so what Vanilla says is exactly right. Just these conversations, if you have a genuine conversation, you learn something.
1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Let's continue the conversation with Connection listeners. Salim is on the line. Hi, Salim.
Yes, hello. I've been on a safari. I actually went on my honeymoon to Kenya, and I've also traveled in southern Africa. My concern is that a lot of times the revenues which are accruing from these ventures, and they're quite lucrative, you know, they charge the earth for safaris these days. Not much of that money seems to be making it to the people who are really the hosts in most of these cases. You know, companies like Abercrombie and Fitch and many others are just multiplying revenues. And I don't know if you can give some examples of particularly responsible safari tourism in terms of, you know, social responsibility as well, which might stand out.
Gaby Whitehouse, let's toss that to you.
Well, I think you're right that there are some big companies with a high profile that have brochures that make you think that they're making a lot of money, and some of them are, but it's an up-and-down business. I think there are individual operators in the various countries who are responsible and who do give a large percentage of the take back to the villages of the people that are supplying all the goods and services for the safari. I think particularly in Zambia, where I'm particularly fond of that area, there's a company called Robin Pope Safaris that is really supporting villages around with their revenue, and they're growing all the vegetables for the camp. Everything is very eco conscious, and they're making a concerted effort, and there are numerous others that are trying to do that. I think the big glitzy ones are giving the general tourism industry a bad name, because there are many people who are trying to make a responsible contribution to the environment that is giving them their sustenance.
But not in all cases does the money does the prevailing wage get paid, so to speak.
Right, and there are in South Africa, particularly, there's a couple of very large companies that are building these incredibly extravagant facilities, and the money goes back, and it's like a chain, like the chaining of America, the same kind of thing, that the money does not go to the local people.
What other problems can safaris cause for the local ecology and economy, as opposed to the benefits it may produce?
Well, it can take away areas that people could be living in, because the national park system is really there to support tourism so that the animals can still have their sway over the environment. If tourism wasn't there, a lot of these parks would be taken up with habitation, human habitation, because as everywhere in the world, population growth is really an issue, although things are changing somewhat in Africa at this point, unfortunately, in that direction, as we know, because of the AIDS epidemic. What we used to say was, you know, relentless population growth is encroaching on wild places. Now that picture is changing every day with what's happening with the AIDS epidemic, so it's hard to say definitively how it's all going to turn out at this point.
Jay Kaiser, in your conversations with the people you met, did they complain about tourism occasionally or frequently?
No, they didn't. I mean, that may be because it was not in their interest to. But I do think that economically it's a win-win situation in the mm-hmm. sense that there are these villages which are given employment, and it is in their best interest not to kill the animals. That's why, for example, I think in this lion encounter, the guy with the gun didn't shoot. I mean, what I learned was that he was under strict orders not to shoot unless it was absolutely necessary. Mm-hmm. And even then he would have shot in the air the first time, because that's a natural resource. So if you look at the safari organizers are kind of like translators. They are the bridge between the civilized, the developed world and people like us who will go on safaris, and that particular industry. And it's an industry which is designed to maintain the status quo. If that industry were to disappear, if the resources were to disappear like the animals, the industry would disappear. And then now there's a considerable, I think, leverage for that not to happen.
1-800-423-TALK, 1-800-423-8255. Let's hear some more experiences. Stuart, you're on the connection.
Hello?
Yes, Stuart, go ahead.
Oh, I was listening earlier to the comment about the accessibility due to cost, and I thought I'd give you a call. I've done it a couple of different ways. I've had the good fortune of getting into Southern Africa as a side trip on a business venture. And then I've also done it myself, kind of a do-it-yourself, hire a car, drive in a Kruger Park type of thing. Mm-hmm. And that really cuts the cost maybe by two-thirds. Mm-hmm. The trade-off, though, is that the real value of the guides and all that, they really do get you close to the animals, as your guests have experienced. And I think if I were to do it again, I would go that route. I'd do it differently, though. I wouldn't start in the U.S. I'd take advantage of the discount fares and the price wars getting to Europe. And London is really the package travel center of the world, and try to get down to Africa that way. So I just thought I'd contribute that and see if there's a response from your guests.
Stuart, thank you very much. Gaby Whitehouse?
Yeah, that's certainly a viable alternative, and there are a lot of price war things going on at this point, and there's also consolidated fares that we are able to get at certain times. And I think the self-driving in Kruger Park model is a great way to, especially for families. It's very well set up, but as you say, you don't get all the expertise and the guides, and and a lot of it is what these people that are living there and know the land so well can impart is a great part of the safari experience.
And Jay Kaiser, as we begin to close here, let me ask you one more question. You are going back.
Yes.
What is it you hope to experience this time, and what is it you fear most about going back again?
What I hope to experience is my safe return, and what I fear most is that I will not return safely.
Jay, I think you will.
Where are you going and when?
We're going to Botswana twice, once on the ground and then once some kind of a... I don't even think about it. I mean, I'll let you know after I come back.
And Connection listeners, Jay Kaiser would be happy to go for you if you pay for his next trip. Jay Kaiser, thank you very much for coming into the Connection
today.
Thank you,
Bob.
Same to you, Gaby Whitehouse.
Thank you.
This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. I'm Bob Oaks, sitting in for Christopher Lyman. Thanks for the callers. We'll be right back.
sets of The Connection are available for $15, including shipping and handling. To order, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287.
Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Alaya Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Instruction Set, providing course development and web-based training in Java, C++.